All right. So I'm going to take a couple of more questions. It's not on? Yeah. Okay. Let me turn my hearing aid on here. What a miracle, really. So okay. Be okay to we go on a little bit now? I know there are more questions, and I'm enjoying you. You're a very inquisitive group. A lot of questions, a lot of really right on questions. So I'm going to talk a little bit more, and then maybe I'll do a little demonstration, and then you can do a little practice round if you want, okay? So, as you have already learned, somebody gave me the most delicious pear. I was just remembering it. I was my mouth all of a sudden was salivating. Oh my gosh! I still have that pear taste in my mouth. So, anyhow, what are the basic roots of traumatization? Well, it happens not caused by necessarily, but happens when there's a threat to our survival in the face of helplessness. Well, when we have helplessness and threat, we are traumatized. And there are two basic types of situations that lead to trauma or that embody trauma. And it's the fight or flight response and the freeze and collapse response. So some people, again, I think it's a relative minority, are worried or are struggling with flashbacks and being on guard all the time. Well, I guess that's not such a minority. And other are just not having energy. I think somebody just described their experience of just, you know, after they were doing this, the shaking exercise of nausea and just not having any energy. That's the collapse response, the freeze collapse response. And when a person is in that, you know, you need to be able to move them out of it enough. Now, what can happen, I've talked about this, but in a somewhat different context, is when you're sitting in meditation and you are in that collapse response, there's nowhere else to go but into more collapse. Now, there are things that one can do, and I think some teachers are utilizing this kind of instruction, is to really look at your posture. When I say posture, I don't mean stand up straight, you know, this kind of thing, chest out, blah, blah. It means the intrinsic way that we sit, whether it's collapse forward and down, whether it's stiff and braced, whether it's leaning to one side or another, those are real important information sources, because we really, our experience is really a scanning of what's going on in our bodies. It really is. So those are the two basic types of traumatic response. And this is terror in the face of helplessness, overwhelming helplessness. This is an opossum. And the expression playing possum is inaccurate. Also, the narrator in that little film said, you know, that it was playing dead, but it's not playing. This is a profound physiological reaction, a psychophysiological reaction, and it involves numbing so you don't feel being torn apart. It also decreases, maybe even removes terror. So it's a really incredible mechanism. However, again, when it becomes chronic, it's a lot of trouble. And it involves we'll talk more about this, but the vagal sympathetic tone, particularly what's called the unmyelinated or the dorsal vagus, the primitive vagus nerve. And it also generally tends to be bimodal. So we're either in shutdown or hyperarousal. And what happens if we don't find a way to do something about that is we're flipping it. One moment we're overwhelmed, and the next moment we're there without any energy. And I think the person who asked the question was talking about that kind of thing. So again, this is, gives us a really useful map. Okay, I don't know, are there any Swedish people here today? Okay, could you please pronounce this for me? I can speak a little Danish, pronounce a little Danish, but this one's beyond my capacity here. Good. That's great. Talk for help. Okay. So again, these are youngsters whose refugee status had been refused, out of their families had been refused, and they go into this what's called resignation syndrome. They're not moving. They just lay there wasting, and that's again that shutdown state. And it's called an energy conservation withdrawal response. And it's there if we're in a situation that's really, really horrible, and we just really need to conserve any energy that we have. And so we just wait there for things to change, just like the Impala was waiting for her environment to change. Two types of immobilization. This is another really, really important part, super important part. One is immobilization with fear, right? The other is immobilization without fear. So the mother prairie vole, it's a male prairie vole that was injected with oxytocin, but for simplification, a female mother, and she's carrying her pups. And you see that with all mammals, right? Your cat, if you've seen a cat, right, or a dog, you know, that's how they keep track of their youngsters and bring them back. But that's immobilization without fear. This is immobilization without fear, right? This is immobilization. But what's the difference between this immobilization and that immobilization? It's the isolation. So again, these are the kind of states that can come up that are the shutdown functions of when we've been abandoned. You know, my infancy, the wisdom, this was Watson and the behaviorists, parents were told never to pick up a child if they were crying, because they would only learn to be dependent and to manipulate you. And they also advised against breastfeeding, because breastfeeding was said to be unsanitary. So, right. Well, I mean, the good news is there's progress there, clearly. No, seriously. But again, you know, if you're, you know, closer to my age, this is probably some of what your experience is. And again, how do you deal with this, because it's from such a lack? But again, there are ways, there are tools, and we will be exploring them as the day goes on. And here's again immobilization without fear. This is how things are supposed to be. We're supposed to be held. We're supposed to be nurtured in this way. Without this, we then, at an age this young, we become the self-protective part. We become the part that's taking over this function as best that it can, because it can't do it very well, but it does it enough to survive and to move into somehow another day. And again, this is something you see anywhere and everywhere in the world. It truly is. It's the key here to attachment. And often in attachment, this kind of posture is left out. And this was really the essence of Bowlby's work. Do you know of Bowlby's work? It's really worth reading his... He has three volumes on bonding and attachment. It's really very important. And it's primate. It's also a mammalian. And it's from cross species. No question about that. And this exploration begins really at the very beginning. This is a newborn, home birth. Oh, wait a minute, that's a tongue. That's my hand. Oh yeah, I remember my hand from being in the uterus. Uh-oh, what's that when my eyes open? That looks different. So already there's a tremendous learning process going on. And as somebody told me, there was a video of a father doing it while the baby was in utero, doing these movements, and they, with a sonogram, they were noticing the infant was mirroring them. Seems pretty far out, but you know, it's not out without the realm of possibility. Yeah, and then again, here, and you know, one of the things that also many, many preemies that would have died, you know, 20 years ago, even 10 years ago, are kept alive. And again, these are also some of the places that people enter into if they've had this kind of a beginning. Now, this is... First, what's your response? You see this image. Yes, right. You want to get up and hold that child and rock that child. We're totally programmed for that. There's no question about that. We don't leave babies like that alone. I was talking once to an evolutionary biologist, and she was saying that she thinks the key of this distress response is so when we were hunter-gatherers and another tribe came in and we had to quickly escape, babies would wail and make movements that would remind the parents not to leave them. I mean, I think there's some truth to it. But this is what's called a Morrow reflex. It's a startle reflex, a startle stress reflex. Excuse me. Supposedly, it goes away at about 8 months. Supposedly. Right. So, again, this is another thing, when we don't have the safe touch that you saw at the very beginning. And we see here, this is kind of really cool. Here is a lady. There was a group of people are sitting together at a table, at a curved table. They're having some kind of a political meeting. And she's pretty tight. I know a bit about her history. It makes sense. Her family escaped from the former East Germany. So there's a lot of stress in the family, a lot of stress. And she became one of the, as often traumatized people do, one of the important leaders of the world, right? This particular lady. But you can see the stress is in her shoulders. So this guy, you'll see, who's kind of clueless, he comes up behind her. He doesn't say anything. And then he starts to massage her shoulders. So, well, I mean, you think, you know, he's really trying to help here. Right. Oop. I know. Let that one go. But again, this is one of the things that when we're primed, when the touch has been lacking in our infancy or has been inappropriate, has violated boundaries, we are very susceptible to experience any touch, in fact, any proximity as threat. So here you are in a room with a bunch of other people meditating. And so you're going into these deep spaces. And in order to do that, there has to be a container of safety created. And I know that happens here. I mean, I know Jack, and I you know, you can just feel it's in the environment. It's made to be felt, perceived, felt as a safe place, safe and not to be not only deeply touched by one's own experience, but to be with other people who are also being touched and are respectfully safe. So important. And again, this is not a matter of just startle. It's quite, quite different. So this is the same lady in a rather different situation. Oh, by the way, the response that she did was exactly what you saw with the infant. That was the startle stress response. Oops, we need a little... Yeah.
Sag noch einer, die Kanzlerin sei nicht cool.
So, there it goes. Okay, so it's not just startle. So the feeling of safety is so important. And my very, very dear friend and colleague, Stephen Porges, talks about a concept that he coined called neuroception. And basically, it's about how we perceive our environments. Do we perceive them as safe, unsafe, or potentially life-threatening? So again, here you see this startle response, also this grasping response with her very early infancy reflexes. Yeah. So what I'm going to do here is just show you a video about how these early responses can change, particularly where there has not been a bonding. And then we're going to look and see again how it's something that we can help provide for ourselves. I'll do a little demonstration with one or two people about this. So this is a 14-month-old toddler, and very intelligent. And he was born with an emergency C-section. There were the cord was around his neck 3 times. And he was wedged up into the apex of the uterus under the diaphragm so tightly that even with the cesarean, they had to still use suction to pull him out. So in other words, the more he pushed, the stucker he would get. So I think there are midwives here, I think you can attest to this, that it's not just the mother pushing, but it's also the fetus pushing against the wall, propelling itself out. And so again, the message he got was that the more you push, the more you embody your energy, the more you stand on your own 2 feet, the more you're going to be trapped. And so he had developed some symptoms that were of concern involving gastric reflux, and they were concerned that there would be penetration into his lungs, but the glottis would change in time. But anyhow, they wanted to do an endoscope and also scope his lungs. And for an infant that's already been traumatized, this would be utterly devastating. Really, severely, severely traumatized. And again, when you see him, he appears to be a normal kid, but not if you watch closely. And that's what I'm going to invite you to do. And also, because all of us, one way or another, were borned presumably, we're going to be affected by this. So again, to use this as an opportunity to notice the sensations and feelings and images that come up as you're watching this. And so anyhow, I want to work with him. Usually when if I would work with the baby, I would take things very slow, we'd get to know each other. But here I knew I had to get in really quickly because I didn't want him to have to go through this procedure. And even if he did, the procedure wouldn't really tell them anything they could do anyhow, you know. So this is baby Jack, 14 months old. So there's connection, there's rhythm, there's movement. They're entrained. Huh? Curiosity reaching out. And pulling back. So he is telling me the story, piece by piece, of exactly what happened to him. He was overwhelmed, you know, with all of the... He was taken away from his mother. They were doing all kinds of, you know, blood pricks and different interventions, so, and all kinds of tubes. So, again, his message is, if I reach out for something that interests me, then I'm going to be overwhelmed. And that's pulling the arm back. But I stay there. Other thing to watch, which is very important, has to do with this that relative safety, is that he maintains eye contact with me throughout the whole thing, the whole session. So now, okay, here, push it. Okay, so he went from helplessness to pushing and agency. He is now beginning to renegotiate the whole birth process, step by step.
You don't like it? Okay.
A little bit, yeah. Because we were cold, so.
Okay. Yeah.
Also, you notice the way she rotates him very quickly. I think that's because he needs that amount of stimulation to quiet. But you'll see how that changes when they're able to attach. Oh, the other thing, often, that when there's been a failure to attach, the bond and attach, you know, it's kind of like a resurgence of the blame the mother kind of thing, that it's somehow the mother was insufficient. And, of course, in many cases that is true. But what I've discovered that's even more prevalent is something happens that breaks that bond, and they're both cut astray, because this whole thing is meant to be an intimate, cooperative developmental process.
Oh, you're
that makes
spinning,
him happy.
Huh?
What are you doing?
You're a spinner.
He's a spinner.
Well, you had quite a difficult time, didn't you, getting into this world?
He did.
Okay. This is really important. You want to keep this in mind. He sees something on my table. It's kind of my weird little altar with three pomegranates. It's interesting because in the most of the European languages, they're called gran apple, you know, big apple. Anyhow, apple.
Apple? It's like an apple.
Yeah.
You can't bite it, okay? You can see, but no more. Okay? You love it?
So again, he pushes away.
You're into pushing, huh? That's okay. Actually, with all those tubes and all this kind of thing, I can see why you'd want to push. Yeah.
And there's that whimper. And, of course, I'm not assuming he's understanding every word that I'm saying. But we all talk, I mean, not all, but many people talk to their babies, of course. And what's important, of course, not the words, but what's called prosody, the rhythm, the intonation. You know, when you hear people talk at one level, it's really kind of bizarre. I mean, I was watching the news a little bit, and this lady who was the press secretary, because she just talked completely in a monotone voice. And I could realize, oh my gosh, you know, there's just no way she's connecting at all with the audience, because there's no rhythm, there's no connection.
Away from you, huh?
Jump in. Say hi. Oh, sweetheart.
Maybe we sit down here.
And... what about this one? Wonder for this one?
Bye-bye. Bye-bye, shoes. Bye-bye, shoes.
Yeah. Very unusual.
So they're wanting to do endoscopy because of the reflux?
They think it's a reflux problem that causes dysphagia for him. He has dysphagia.
So things happen really quickly here. He's pushing now. You say, well, is he pushing away from me? But again, we notice the eye contact. He's maintaining the eye contact. So whatever he's doing, he feels safe enough to do it. And again, I moved in there quickly. And when she mentioned the endoscope, the two of them stiffened their back. So I could see that. It was almost like they did it in complete unison. So I'm putting my hand there where the stiffening was. And again, he continues contact and starts to feel more and more his power.
Hi, sweetie. Yeah.
He has what they call penetration. It's going...
And see, again, he just maintains contact with me, even though I'm making contact with her.
Down the wrong tube, then last minute the epiglottis folds over, and so he's not actually aspirating. He's never had pneumonia. He's never even had a respiratory infection.
That's a touchy area, huh?
What is it?
I wish we had more time to play.
What is it?
But since you're having this procedure, it would be nice if you don't have to have the procedure, huh?
Nice.
Yeah.
There. Now he's really pushing. I'm offering him some resistance, and he's really pushing. And again, maintaining direct gaze.
Yeah.
Oh, that's
it. Yeah, it's okay. You can push me. Yeah.
What's the matter, sweetheart?
Actually, that's the wrong title. It's really releasing.
That's okay.
And a lot of birth frequency cries as well.
Kinds of people touching in not such nice ways. Huh? That's worth a good cry, huh?
That's a good way to
say it. Yeah. Oh. By the way, this area that is touching, have you put your hand? No, Mama's going to put her. This is real. He's going to.
He wants. This is it. He's got the pushing away now.
Part of this reflex, the reflex area. Right. It's okay. Very, very tight there.
Okay.
I don't know if you could hear it. The first time she says, he never cries.
Yeah.
Oh, here it is. Like, he never cries.
I was just going to ask you.
She's never seen tears.
It's like a very emotional release. This is something that needs to happen. Yeah.
I mean, I can't remember the last time I saw tears actually rolled down his face.
Yeah. We really got that place, huh? Also, if you see him pushing,
like, there it goes.
Hands, just give him a little resistance and with your hands and fingers.
Get out of my space. Get out of my space. Get out of my space.
Because he really has, you know, when you have all these tubes and this kind of stuff, the baby, you know, the infant wants to do anything to get rid of it, but it's so small and helpless. Yes.
You see her amazement, and you see now this happens for the first time ever. And she says, I'm not sure what to do with this. But she knows exactly what to do with it. Jack knows exactly what to do to get her to do what he needs her to do. Yeah. And again, he's getting the response, but what if you have the situation where the baby is not getting the response, where there's no call and response. So.
I'm sure what to do,
let
doesn't
it well. Yeah.
I was really hot.
He's really hot. So that's vasodilation. That's a deep parasympathetic response. And the rocking, you see how different the rocking is than when she started. Because now their nervous systems are in tuned.
Great. Yeah.
Okay.
And again, these are the kind of things that are very likely to happen during meditation.
Now, here he goes. See how he's breathing in and out? You can see, so that even though it looks a little unpleasant to look at him convulsing like that, in fact, it lets off all that stress, and he then is able to relax and sleep the thing off.
That's wonderful.
So that's the molding, again, that never happened, but was just moments away.
Fantastic. Let's watch this.
So she'd never experienced him as still.
And when is the appointment for the endoscopy? Has that been set?
No, they haven't scheduled it yet.
Okay,
they haven't
good.
Back yet.
Good. Let's see what happens here. I don't want to do any more. I think this is just the right amount, especially since he had such a strong reaction, very uncharacteristic.
Yeah, I mean, I've never.
Yeah.
Never seen that. Even when he gets frustrated, he's not. He goes to sleep. He's
really relaxing now, really molding into you.
Oh, sweetheart, are you okay?
Yeah. Okay. And you're so relaxed, huh? That's really great. Yeah. So let's watch this for a while. And I'm going to give you you have my cell phone, right?
Yes.
Okay. I'd like you to report Actually, I'd like you to write down everything that you're noticing that in any way it seems different.
This seems
different. Oh, look at that smile.
Oh. But that's more like shyness rather than withdrawal.
This actually seems different because normally when he'll hug you, but then he's on to the next thing.
So he's really settling in, huh?
Yeah.
Get things moving. Yeah, oh, what a smile. You have a really nice smile.
Can you say
hi? You really do. Hi, Jack. Hi, Jack.
How did they know your name?
Yeah. You are, oh, my goodness.
I'm a little overexcited, I think.
Smile. What a smile. Yeah, yeah. All right.
Like, this is...
Look at that
very
smile.
It's
unusual.
It's very,
yeah.
You just see her delight. But she didn't know that that was missing. He didn't know that that was missing. But then there was a reunion.
He's very affectionate, but he's not still unless he's sleeping. And the funny thing is, by himself, he's very peaceful.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. You know, he'll be still.
You know, and again, that's another thing sometimes also. When we're alone, you know, when there's been that attachment disruption, we're okay. You know, we're doing our independent thing. And but then when we're with another person, the relating is a challenge. And I think that's also another important thing when in meditation, when we're coming out, you don't have to make verbal communication, but just to make some connection with people around you.
But without people, he's usually touching or stroking or...
Well, you have a lot of stuff working through there, huh?
Yeah.
That's right.
This is just a reporting session, really.
Computer, and this morning my printer doesn't work, but I did jot down some notes of the most important stuff that's been happening. And probably one of the biggest things was at 1:30 that night, after we were here, he woke up, which isn't normal for him. He's not a great sleeper, but it's usually he'll wake up more towards the morning. Mm-hmm. He woke up and he didn't cry. He just called out, "Mama."
Huh.
I went in to get him. He did this.
Uh-huh.
And then was patting me for a little bit and said, "Apple." Apple. And I thought he wanted to eat, and I asked him. He wasn't doing his normal thing. If he wants to eat normal, he's like out of my lap trying to go get food. And I thought he must have been talking about or made the association.
Yeah.
So this is key. What he's now doing is forming a memory. Not just the body memory, a procedural memory, but he's actually invoking different images. And, you know, in academic psychology, they say that we're not able to do that at least till we're 3.5 or 4, which is when we start to be more narrative. But it's clear to me it happens very early. This is the beginning of what are called episodic-like memories, or autobiographical memories.
So this is not him. I mean, this is the new him, but...
And how about when he's active? What's his energy like?
Really, he's been really good. He's sick. Mm-hmm. He's got, you know, he had the cold that he had here before, and we're actually going to his primary care. He's been a lot more talkative.
But, I mean, he's so talkative. Hi.
Yeah.
And in what ways?
And I don't know if this is just as they get older, but it's been noticeable that he's been much more interactive with us.
Uh-huh.
He wants to show us a lot of things.
In this last week.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Wants to show us more, wants our feedback more.
Yeah.
And this is just, I can't tell you, he's always been a very affectionate kid, but for him to sit and just be cuddled in is a complete change. I mean, it's just, it's wonderful for me, but it's just totally unlike the way that he was before.
So, help me. I was going to either do a little demonstration with somebody or take questions. We won't have time to do both. At lunch, I assume, is at 1, right? Okay, we'll do a demo. What I'm going to do is just have somebody come up and to just, because remember, again, one of the things we really want to look at is where these things are embodied within us, even if we didn't have that holding, nurturing environment or didn't have it sufficiently. Those inner holding archetypes, again, not in just in the form of images, but in the form of inner movements. And I noticed as we were watching this video that a number of you started moving a little bit slightly like this or like this. What you're doing is what she was doing for him. She was holding him and helping him regulate his sensations so that they not be overwhelmed. So again, that's the key. Once we get this stage of development a little bit more under our belts, we're more able to deal with the more intense sensations that start to emerge. So it's really important, again, I think that we have to look at meditation as a developmental process, and that it mirrors in many ways the development that we've experienced, you know, as incarnating humans on this planet in this particular interesting time in history. So what I'm going to ask, if somebody wants to do a little demonstration, I'll take you. Come on up here. And you are?
Moshumi.
Very good to meet you. I'm going to, somebody's going to put the microphone on you. And then you can just have a seat after he gets this on you. You may want to get the hair a little bit out. Is that okay? Have what? Okay, so you want me to work fast? Oh, okay. No, that's why I said we can either do questions or this, but not both before lunch. So I'm doing my best. I'm not perfect, as others have noticed. Come on, have a little seat down here. I'm going to move around here. I'd like to have you, if you're okay, for just a little bit here.
Okay.
Let me pull this out, actually, a little bit here, so I want you to feel, again, not so far to the edge. Okay. So I'm just going to have you sit down, and I'm going to ask you to just notice your body, notice your posture. Your breath, sensations in your feet, hands. Belly.
Some movement in my belly.
Yeah, you feel some movement. Okay, so as you feel that movement, if it's okay with you, I'd like to put my hands on your upper arms and your shoulders. And what I'm going to do is I'm just going to wait there with my hands just to, you know, kind of provide some element of support. And then let's just notice if there are any inner movements, okay?
Okay,
so here I go. And you tell me if you want less or more pressure, or if you want me to move my hands in some way. So you're okay. Totally in control here, okay?
Okay.
Okay, so my hands here. Immediately notice a change in respiration. So again, I'm going to just allow a little time.
More pressure.
Yeah, there we go. I don't know if you noticed it, but her spine lengthened. How are you doing, Ishimi?
I'm fine.
You can say what you noticed.
I'm fine. Definitely relaxation. Mm-hmm. A little movement in my feet. That feeling in my stomach has risen up more, so I feel more sensation throughout my torso, not just in my stomach.
Okay. Good. Mm. Now, I'm noticing her body, as she was talking, starting to shift a little bit to her right. And so I'm just following that. And then to the left. Again, I'm not moving her. I'm helping form the container for the sensations, but these movements are coming from her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I noticed that during the video as well.
Aha.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. The breath feels easier now. It's moving into my throat.
Yeah. Now there's like a rhythm between the breath and the movement. Mm-hmm. Very lovely.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah, it feels more natural. Then I feel more natural than I did before.
Uh-huh. Wow. It's an interesting word. Oh. Really, more natural. Mm. It's beautiful, really. Really wonderful. So again, in her movement, she is giving herself the physical embodiment of loving kindness. Wow.
It's really nice to feel contained.
Yes. And again, that's specifically what I'm providing with my hands. And again, she adjusted the pressure to so that she feels more contained. Wow.
I feel safer to look around.
Aha, wonderful. So as you're looking around, maybe just noticing the sea of colors, maybe even through the window, the grass, the nature. And also to the people here in the room. Colors, shapes, faces. You know, perhaps there's one or two faces that you really want to linger with a little bit.
I couldn't look at anybody before.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And again, that's what happens when we're in the shutdown state. Or the fight or flight, especially in the shutdown, we cannot look at other people. It actually feels really bad. There was an experiment that Ruth Lanius did in Toronto. She has probably the biggest, most expensive brain scanners in the known universe. And she showed a picture of a friendly face to a number of people, a control group of people. And you can just continue what you're watching. And again, maybe also drawing in what you see, as though your eyes were like magnets, just drawing in different images. Yeah. And and then another breath and comes to a little bit of stillness. Anyhow, when she saw that picture of the control group in the scanner, the front prefrontal portions of the brain lit up, the medial parts of the prefrontal or ventromedial parts of the prefrontal cortex lit up, and the activity in the amygdala decreased.
Mm-hmm.
That's no surprise. But what was surprising is when she showed the same picture to a group of people who had early trauma, particularly trauma involving relationship, well, early trauma all does, she showed them the same picture, and instead of the prefrontal areas increasing, they decreased markedly, and the area in her brainstem called the periaqueductal gray lit up. That's the area involved with fear, terror, helplessness, and immobility. So again, as therapists, sitting across to clients may not be the best way to work with them. I usually have my chairs kind of at 90 degrees so we can make contact or not make contact, so they can do work that they're needing to do internally. And then there we go, another breath. And again, I mean, this, I think probably many of you have experienced these kinds of movements, or if not, if you felt the impulse to let these movements happen, I encourage you.
I'm getting sleepy.
And as you feel sleepy, how do you notice that? Where do you experience it? How do you experience it?
Muscular relaxation.
Muscular relaxation.
A sense of safety.
Okay.
Like, rhythm.
Wow. Remember the sea anemones? Rhythm, flow. And it's slowly, and the amplitude is decreasing. And then we're here just at rest. Wow. And what I'm experiencing is this deep stillness, flow and stillness. How are you doing?
Great. This life feels like as though I just meditated for 45 minutes.
Well, I mean, we can call it accelerated meditation. But again, how you use these embodiment experiences for your as part of your meditative toolbox. Wow. That breath just feels like you're expanding, expanding, expanding. So is it okay if I take my hands off?
Yeah.
And then I'll just move back to my chair, okay?
Okay.
And just let you sit here for a little bit.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Mm-hmm. You're entirely welcome. And again, if it's okay to talk to the class, the audience.
Sure.
This is, again, part of this social engagement system, which comes into activity when we're feeling safe, but also when we're feeling deeply safe in ourselves. It's a tautology, but so I'm just going to move there, yeah?
Okay.
So, again, just taking just some moments to, yeah, this might be nice to have this a little bit.
Thank you.
I was hoping we'd find one of those.
Thank you.
And just checking out a little bit in the room.
I noticed some other people get sleepy around the time that I started feeling sleepy.
Yeah, it's a kind of a resonance.
Yeah, I noticed some people yawning. And,
Yeah. Yes, what you're experiencing is infectious. Thankfully, I mean, literally. Literally. And again, thinking about this, when you have a whole room full of people experiencing things like this, what the effect of that is. It really, I'm so taken by the Islamic religion, where again, they come in and they do the rocking movements and the prostrations, which is similar to some of the Tibetan Buddhism. And but they're at their, what's it, five times a day, they're doing it. Everybody on the whole planet that's Muslim is doing it. Oh my gosh. Think about that. So, how do things look?
Safe, friendly.
Great. Well, let's just leave it there. You're welcome to just sit here for a little bit, because I'm going to use my next 5 minutes to finish the thing with Baby Jack. Okay. So he was party version, right? It was my technical person did that. I blame it on him. So, this is kind of interesting. Okay, first of all, when mother took him to the doctor, he was really, he was scared and he was crying on the way back. And he said, pizza. And mother said, oh, you want a pizza? You want pizza? And he said, no, pizza, apple pizza. So again, this is these new memories are now being constellated. I mean, can you imagine that? Okay. This, we're still not done with the story. So I asked them to come in, I think when he's 4.5 years old. Four and a half. And just to see how things are. Of course, he didn't have to have the procedure. But he, I opened the door, and they're together, and she says to him, Jack, do you remember Peter? Do you remember Dr. Levine? And he said, no. And then as they walked in the room, he said, Mama, is he going to put his hand on my back? So she was also describing that he's a very active kid. He's always been very bright, but he was on his baseball team, and he was spent most of his time with his peers. But, you know, if he was upset, he'd come to his mom and do this. So anyhow, they come in the room, and he gets in her lap like this and asks me to put my hand on his back. Yeah. Okay. So we have 3 minutes, Swiss time. I'll take us. There are any questions? Okay, right over there.
Didn't.
Over here, the gentleman in there.
I'm sure you're familiar with the procedure called EMDR. Would you say because of lack of titration, it becomes problematic?
I think everything where you're working with these kind of experiences, you have to titrate them, because that gives you the most safety. And I think, I mean, a lot of people who are EMDR therapists are in our trainings. So I think that they're, you know, this is cross-pollinating. I mean, again, the centrality of the body and how to deal with these sensations, not just evoking them, but really how to integrate them, how to work with them, how to transform those difficult emotions. Yes. We have a couple over here, like 3, 4, 5, 6.
Just wanted to ask if there's a meaning to yawning from your perspective?
Yes. Yawning, actually, especially yawning, which you gently move into the yawning and then let the mouth close a little bit and move into it till you feel the resistance and then back. That will often give an inner vibration, an inner shaking, and particularly it releases the diaphragm. And so if you, again, when you're meditating, I'm sure, well, for me it's true, I assume for most of you it's true, many of you it's true, you start to yawn. And again, the thing to do is not to suppress it, because that's what some people do. I don't want to yawn, I want to stay concentrated. Or they take quickly a very wide yawn. When you do that, you don't get that really internal effect that you do. Let's try it together, okay? So again, just a little bit opening, and then letting it close a little bit. And then, yes, that's it, and opening it till you start feeling the beginning of that, some flutter or some movements of your body. Play the edge. Play the edge. And then if anybody asks you, what is somatic experience, you say, oh, yeah, you yawn. So again, noticing what happens to your sensations, to your breath. Okay. Well, I'm 15 seconds over. So wait a minute, what time are we coming back? Help me, somebody. 2:15. Okay? Okay, see you then.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.